Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. It's incredible, but it's estimated that between 50 and 200 species go extinct every day. National Geographic photographer Joel Sartori is on a mission to keep sustaining animals, insects, and habitat that are endangered through a photographic documentary project called the National Geographic Photo Ark. It's on display at the Ned Smith Center for Nature and Art in Millersburg, Dauphin County, through the end of August. And it's an honor to speak with National Geographic photographer Joel Sartori. Mr. Sartori, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. That's the number to call. You can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Joel Sartori, I want to go back a few years. There was a feature on CBS this morning, Sunday morning, a few years ago that started, and it just really had an impact on me. It started by saying, "The eyes will haunt you," talking about the photographs of the animals, the insects that you have. Talk about that, because those eyes jump out at you in these photographs.
Right. With the photo arc, we hope to engage people, and as a photographer, I couldn't think of a better way to do that than just through eye contact. People are primates, and we really respond to that. That's a huge deal. And there's been lots of studies showing that if people go to a zoo, their experience is enhanced immeasurably if an animal makes eye contact with them.
Mm. Well,
so I just figured this might be the thing to get these pictures to become more memorable. If we tried to do that with every animal that has eyes, at least. A lot of the animals don't, like coral and some other invertebrates don't have eyes, but most do, so it seems to be working.
So as you, and we're going to talk about this throughout the program, about some of the methods you use, because your subjects are not exactly like human beings that you can get them to pose and do what you want for a photograph. How do you get them to make eye contact?
Well, at any point during our shoots, and most shoots are 5 minutes or less, they'll look back at me or at the camera. Most of the time, for small animals, they only see the front of the lens, which probably looks like one big eye to them. And they'll glance at it once in a while, and all we need is a real brief little moment, because the flashes are fast and the shutter speed's fast. And the nice thing about still photography is pictures can kind of become iconic, and you don't... A lot of times you can take them out of context. So an animal may be roaming around the enclosure it's in that's prepped to look like a studio, but if it looks back at me just for a moment, it looks like a willing participant.
Well, they certainly are iconic, and I would encourage anyone who has the opportunity to see these photographs at the Ned Smith Center in Millersburg to do that. We have a few on our website, WITF.org. What inspired you to begin the Photo Ark project?
Yeah, I'd been a globetrotting National Geographic photographer for about 17 years, and then my wife got breast cancer, and so I went from being in the field to being home and taking care of her and our three kids, and she's fine now. That was about 13 years ago. But during the time at home, I started thinking about the fact that I didn't really like the fact that the stories I was working on, I did 30 stories in the field, that they would come and go in a month. I wanted to come up with something that would stick and would last. And photo arc was it, just doing really simple portraits of animals on black and white backgrounds using studio lighting so that we can really look these animals in the eye, and also because without any size comparison, all animals are equal. So a mouse counts as much as an elephant. So that's kind of how we got started.
So, you know, I mentioned endangered species, and let's talk about that. I use the word incredible to think that between 50 and 200, these are estimates, and that's a wide range there, wide disparity. In fact, I've seen estimates even higher than that, but 50 to 200 species go extinct every day. That's every day. That is incredible.
Yeah, where that number comes from is a wild guess. Based on the amount of acres of deforestation happening every day, because a lot, and it's invertebrates mostly, it's animals that are insects that live in some of these forests, and they have a very small range, or they ex- occur in a very small area. If those woods are completely destroyed, clear cut, then that's it. So nobody really knows, but we do think that within the next 50 or 60 years, we could lose up to half of all species, big ones, small ones, you name it. So that's what concerns me in the photo arc's design, to get people to pay attention and hopefully be inspired to take action in how they live their daily lives as consumers, all the way to helping to support captive breeding program or reef programs or reforestation. So that's kind of the goal, is to get people to think about extinction and that it's permanent and that there are things we can do about it.
So how many animals or species have you photographed that are now extinct, that no longer exist?
Oh, probably a dozen. It's hard to say. We know three or four for sure, but maybe a dozen. And I think that there's not a month goes by, I don't meet an animal we're pretty sure will go extinct without immediate serious help. But there are, there's a lot of work to do. And it can be a little overwhelming for most people. Most people are like, man, I mean, what can I do? I live in Lititz, Pennsylvania. What can I do? Well, there's a lot of things people can do. And the first step is awareness in how we consume. What are we spending our money on? Are we driving a big car needlessly? Are we driving less, a smaller car? Is our home insulated? Are we eating less meat? Are we putting chemicals on our lawn? These are all questions we can ask ourselves and make the earth a better place. I always tell people, don't try to think about saving the whole planet, just start in your own backyard. And it feels pretty good to know that you're at least doing what you can.
I'm curious, what are some of those animals that you photographed that are now extinct?
Yeah, one's called the Rab's Fringed Limb Tree Frog. The very last one was a male that lived at the Atlanta Botanical Gardens, and it passed away a couple of years ago now, and so we're pretty sure there aren't any left. They're a pretty big frog, and they were very vocal in the night in Panama in the jungles, and they were wiped out by a fungus that spread around the world. Another one's the Columbia Basin pygmy rabbit, which was a small kind of a bunny that lived in eastern Washington, but it was wiped out because everything out there was plowed, and they can't live in plowed fields. They have to have sagebrush habitat and the grasses that dominated eastern Washington back when, before farming became so prevalent. So those are a couple, but it's mostly small stuff. But we're looking at some big animals now that are right on the edge of extinction, too. The northern white rhino is down to two, both females, a mother and daughter. There's a giant soft-shell turtle in China that's down to two. There's and bigger things like the South China tiger, which is down to about 100 or so in captive breeding programs, but none in the wild. So we see that all the time, unfortunately, and I don't let it get me down or depressed. It just inspires me to try to work harder.
So you have photographs of the animals you mentioned?
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what impact do you want the photo arc, impact do you want it to have on people?
That's a great question. We want people to just become aware of the fact that there's a lot going on out there other than the price at the pump and politics and who won the ball game. That we're talking about the future of life on Earth. It's kind of silly to think that we could doom so many other species to extinction and think that people will be just fine. It's not going to work that way. We really do need clean water, fresh air. We need intact rainforests to help regulate the amount of rainfall we get in the places where we know how to grow crops, like Pennsylvania or Nebraska, where I'm from. So it's really important for people to realize that as these other species go away, so could we. And so, the goal is to just, first of all, educate people, create public awareness, get them to realize that how we spend our money matters, that we help to tear the world down or help build it up, depending on how we spend our money. Just things as simple as not putting chemicals on our lawn and driving a smaller car and insulating our homes. These are all things that really do matter in the long run.
You talked about deforestation, but what you just described is what many people advise to try to reduce the dangers of climate change, or at least right. slow it down. So let me bring that into it. Besides deforestation, and I assume climate change, are there other factors that are leading to the extinction of this habitat, these animals, these insects?
You bet. Right. Well, first of all, the main driver is habitat alteration or elimination. If you cut all the forest down in a particular area, the animals have no place to live. They can't live on a farm or a palm oil plantation. They need healthy, intact rainforest. So that's the first thing. But there are many things driving extinctions. There's invasive species, animals that we've introduced somehow to an area that shouldn't be there, that are super competitive. They outcompete or they hybridize animals that are already there. This applies to plants, too. Plants are really important, but I do not have time to do a plant arc. But it's mainly habitat loss. It's also overfishing in the oceans, poaching. I was just in Indonesia. The collecting or poaching of birds for the pet trade there is astounding. Many of the forests are completely silent now. So these are, you know, it's all stuff driven by people, which makes me think that people can reverse it, turn it around. But it starts with education. It starts with people meeting these animals and getting excited about them. I mean, they're never going to save something that they don't love. And that's where the photo art comes in.
Now, you have traveled the world, as you've described. But
yeah.
At the same time, for the photo arc, correct me if I'm wrong, are all these photographs from zoos and sanctuaries, or most of them?
Most of them, yes. Yeah, sometimes we'll go out with a crew of field biologists into the field, and if they're netting birds for a banding survey or to put satellite trackers on the birds, we'll photograph them before they're outfitted with tracking devices or leg bands. But most of the time we work at good zoos, wildlife sanctuaries, wildlife rehabbers who take injured and orphaned wildlife, nurse it back to health, and aquariums. And that's because it's very hard to convince a wild tiger come out of the woods and sit on my background and get his picture taken. So we know that if we work at these places that have animals in human care, we're going to be able to make their picture if the zoo agrees it's a good idea.
With that said, example you gave of the tiger coming out of the woods and
yeah.
Using the background, again, in that I go back to that CBS Sunday Morning piece where there was a chimpanzee that tore down your
yeah.
background and ran
yeah.
with it, and there was a bird
right.
pecking at your camera. They don't
yeah.
always cooperate either.
No, sometimes they're pretty tough. We work with zoos for months in advance of me getting to a place, and the zoo's like, okay, we think you've asked to photograph these 20 animals. We think these 15 would be good subjects. Five we don't think we should do. They're too nervous, or they live in a big open aviary if it's a bird, and we can't catch it up. So we just work with the zoo or aquarium, and we try to get through it. But people ask me a lot, what's the hardest animal to photograph? To me, that's pretty easy. It's those chimps. They're fast and they're smart and kind of aggressive, and I still to this day don't have a good picture of an adult chimp.
Really? See, now that would be, maybe it's because we're so used to seeing chimps that have been trained or in
yeah.
captivity that, you know, they're doing cute little tricks and all that for
yeah.
people. But the most difficult chimps, huh?
Yeah, for me, because I'm not working, I mean, I don't have an aversion to working with trained animals. It's just that we generally don't. We go to these places that are doing a lot of conservation work, like zoos and aquariums. They're really conservation centers now, and not menageries anymore, the good ones. And so they're working with animals that are breeders for eventual release in the wild, or we're just working with places that really aren't dealing with trained animals much. So that's why it's a little difficult.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Our guest during this portion of the program is National Geographic photographer Joel Sartori. We're talking about his project, and it's a 25-year project, the Photo Arc. It's the National Geographic Photo Arc. Thousands of pictures, photographs of species, endangered species, some even extinct out there, to bring attention to the plight of these animals, these insects, those even underwater that could be in danger here in around the world. We We really like to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Mr. Sartori, how many covers have you had on National Geographic now? I know it was five at one point.
Yeah, I think it was the international editions. There's a few more than that. But in April a couple years ago, when Geographic launched the photo arc in a major way, they did 10 covers in the same month, 10 different covers of the photo arc. So I don't know whether to count that as one for 1 month or 10. But either way, I like it.
And yeah, it's still quite an honor and says a whole lot. How many photographs are in the ARC now, and what is your goal?
Right now, we photographed about 8,300 or 8,400 species. The world has between 12 and 15,000 animals in human care. At zoos and aquariums and wildlife rehabbers and captive breeders. And so what we're hoping to do is get all of them. And we have to go farther now to get fewer, but we figure another 15 years max, maybe another 14 or 13 years, we'll get it done.
I'm curious, what was the very first one?
The very first one was a naked mole rat at the Lincoln Children's Zoo. That's an animal that not many people know about. It's a completely weird animal, and it just was kind of random. I went to the Lincoln Children's Zoo is about a mile from my house, and when my wife was ill and I was home, on days when she'd feel good, I'd be looking for something to do to just get out of the house, and I just went down to the zoo and asked if I could photograph a couple animals on clean backgrounds, like black and white backgrounds. And so they got something white for me. I think it was a new kitchen cutting board, and we put this naked mole rat on it for a few minutes and got a couple pictures, and that started the whole thing.
What's your favorite animal that has participated in this project, but been part of the ARC?
Yeah, I get asked that a lot, and I always tell people my favorite is the next one, because I have to not discriminate and just, I can't just care about the charismatic bigger animals like parrots or lions or gorillas. I mean, I really have to think about the sparrows and the frogs and the toads of the world, and smaller, insects and clams and mussels and coral. So I always say the next one, so that way I'm not discriminating and I'm treating all things equally and with respect. And the photographs do too, like I mentioned earlier, with no size comparison. These animals are all the same size, and they all, to me, they all show a beauty and a grace that's worth saving, not just for what these animals can do for us in terms of, like, pollinating insects are important to us, or it's important just, I think, to preserve them because it's the right thing to do.
Let's take a phone call from Otto in Gettysburg. Otto, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call.
I
work as an environmental educator, have for about 45 years, and I'm reminded of what Rachel Carson said about every child on the planet is born with a sense of wonder. And but it has to be encouraged. If it's not encouraged by a diligent adult companionship and efforts, it'll flicker out. And when that happens, there are huge implications for decision-making that make wise environmental sense. And I appreciate what your guest is doing to encourage that sense of wonder.
Thank you very much for your call.
Thank you. Yeah, that's important to note. I had really good parents that cared about nature, and we didn't do a lot. We didn't do any hiking or camping, but my mother appreciated her suburban backyard birds and flowers, and my father would take us out hunting and fishing, mushroom hunting in the springs in Nebraska, and they taught me to really appreciate nature, and that's huge. If they didn't care, I don't know that I would have cared so much. So it is about nurture for sure, as well as nature.
And as far as the project goes, the ARC, the photo ARC, you really do encourage young people to get a look at this, correct?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I really hope that public schools and private schools both start start to take more of an interest in environmental education and conservation. That's very important, to just so that people can get a handle on the fact that this is a major part of our existence, is having other animals, plants and animals, thrive. That creates a healthy planet. So I can't stress that enough. If we don't get people when they're young, odds are when they grow up, they're not going to think about this much.
We have a couple of emails. One says, Mr. Sartori, your photographs are beautiful. I'd love to support your project and enjoy the photographs at home. Do you sell a photo arc book?
We sure do. We sell it through our office, signed copies. They can just go to PhotoArc or joelsartori.com, or they can buy the book on Amazon. Those are unsigned, but a little less expensive. So they can also, if they want to support the PhotoArc, they can also go to National Geographic and learn how there. Geographic sponsors the work, and I would encourage anybody to go to Geographic and see what they have to say as well. They're a tremendous organization that really does care.
Now, in sheer size, I can see the difference, but what is the main difference between a book and what someone can see at the Ned Smith Center in Millersburg?
Sure. Well, the book is pretty inclusive. That was done during the halfway point. So we had about 5,000 species photographed at the time we did the book, and the exhibition just kind of plays on what we think of as the best or most interesting pictures from the book and makes them huge. So the exhibition is a chance to really get up close and personal to these animals, and also I'll be speaking there this weekend.
At Ned Smith?
That's right.
What day and time will that be?
I figure you'd ask me that. Since I'm flying out on Friday, I bet I speak there on Saturday.
Okay.
Better get that straight before I get out there, though, shouldn't I?
Yeah, and we'll make sure we have that on our website, WITF.org.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's Saturday.
Now, when there are photographs, is there also an explanation of the animals, a little bit of background on
subject? We try to have captions that educate people either to, you know, interesting things about the animal or where it was photographed or both, just to get people aware of the fact that you know, these animals all have a great story to tell, but we just have to listen. That's a huge deal.
You said, and this is an email from a listener, you said that the photo shoots take about 5 minutes. How much time and logistics go into preparing for that quick five-minute shoot?
Yeah, well, some birds especially, if they're high-strung, we try to get done very quickly, so 5 minutes. Some animals, if they're sitting in there eating and having a great time, like some primates, we may take a little bit longer with them. So the time varies really depending on the animal. Each shoot's very different. Oh, and I wanted to mention, I just looked on my calendar and can tell you the time on the event. It looks like 3 to 4 o'clock. It's a 45-minute talk on the photo arc. 3 to 4 on Saturday, and then we have a reception afterwards.
And that is at the Ned Smith Center for Nature and Art in Millersburg in Dauphin County. You know, we had talked earlier about the conditions that are leading to the extinction of some of these animals.
Yeah.
What about some success stories? Are there some animals out there that were on the verge of extinction, were endangered, that now are thriving?
Yeah, there sure are. There have been lots of success stories. And that really gives me hope, because I meet people that are really on the front lines of this. The California condor, the black-footed ferret, the Mexican gray wolf, these are all animals that got down to fewer than 18 individuals, but they're thriving today because people cared. So that's really important for people to know that one person can make a huge difference.
And again, I encourage anyone who, first of all, we have a couple samples on our website, WITF.org. You can see the beautiful photographs, but go to the Ned Smith Center for Nature and Art, Millersburg, this week. Saturday, 3 to 4, our guest, National Geographic photographer Joel Sartori, will be there. Mr. Sartori, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Sure appreciate it.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. The nation's fastest growing population, actually Pennsylvania's as well, is Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. Like other racial and ethnic groups, they are facing challenges like opioid addiction, sexual assaults, and bullying. A seminar or I should say a symposium, is being scheduled for the State Museum this weekend to address those issues. Joining us to talk about the symposium, talk about these issues, Tiffany Chang Lawson, Executive Director of Governor Tom Wolf's Advisory Commission on Asian Pacific American Affairs. Tiffany Chang Lawson, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Scott. Pleasure to be here.
Also joining us is Dr. Sue Mukherjee, who is Vice Chair of the Commission. Dr. Mukherjee, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott, and congratulations on Smart Talk's 10-year anniversary.
Well, thank you. You are the first to congratulate us.
Yes.
Yeah, we are starting to publicize that a little bit. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Tiffany, let me start with you. You were on the program just a few months ago to discuss the work of your commission and, as I said, the fastest growing population in Pennsylvania, Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. At the time, we talked about how so many had stereotypes of Asian Americans in particular. Everyone is skilled at mathematics or comes from a stable home. Now, those aren't bad stereotypes to have. We say that right off the bat. But it assumes that everyone is the same. But Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in Pennsylvania are dealing with a lot of the same problems as everyone else, correct?
That is correct. So, Scott, what we're seeing is, you know, and we talked about this back in May with the model minority myth, there's this perception that, you know, Asian Americans, we're all doctors, scientists, and lawyers, but these problems exist within our community. And so this was really by listening to the community, and Sue can talk a little bit more to that, how we came up with the idea for the symposium. This was just supposed to be our regular Harrisburg town hall, maybe 50 to 60 folks coming. And this was really a groundswell that happened, and we decided on these topics.
And the topics that you're talking about, what I mentioned in the introduction?
Absolutely. So we're going to be focusing our symposium on the opioid epidemic, sexual assault and domestic violence, as well as bullying and microaggressions, specifically in the Asian American Pacific Islander community.
Microaggressions, define that if you would. When I saw that, I was like, okay, I think I have an idea, but in your definition of microaggressions.
So microaggressions are the casual degradation of any marginalized or targeted population, often unintentional. Microaggressions can break a person or a group down and have long-lasting effects. These effects can harm or destroy the psyche and cause systematic and interpersonal inequities to persist. So these are everyday things. For Asian Americans, you know, for me, actually, it's like, you know, where are you from? And I'm like, I'm from Pittsburgh. but no, where are you really from? Because the idea is that, you know, Asian Americans were the perpetual foreigner, and we, you know, don't really belong to Pennsylvania.
The perpetual foreigner. And, you know, people, you when someone sees you, you're Asian. Mm-hmm. It's obvious that you're Asian.
Yep.
So when they hear you're from Pittsburgh, they're taken aback by that?
Somehow it doesn't click that somebody that looks like me could be native to this land. And, you know, that's why bullying, specifically bullying of Asian American students and Pacific Islander students, as well as Asian American Muslim students, is really at an all-time high, because you can't, we're easily identifiable. You know, you can't change the way that you look at people that are Asian, whether you're Indian, Filipino, Chinese, Indonesian. We are all look distinctly Asian.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Mukherjee, your role, your full-time job, I guess you would say, is your vice chancellor of the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education. So you're dealing with a large population of not just native-born Americans, but people that are coming from all over the world in the state system. Talk about that a little bit. I mean, in fact, many, many people have come to the United States for an education.
Absolutely. Thank you, Scott. And Assistant Vice Chancellor, to be specific. We have 14 universities spread across our beautiful state, and 102,000 strong. Many of our students are from the distinct 29 ethnic variations of Asian American Pacific Islander that we affectionately called AAPI. Mm-hmm. They are young. They are growing, a diverse population, but there is a commonality. They are here for fulfillment through education. But in the communities that they live, there is a silence around some of these tough issues. You know, they have parents like me. I have two millennials, API, AAPI. They've been busy working and living, but for a good amount of time, they have been very, very silent about the tough issues that may be facing their friends and families. I have to give credence to community members who have come together to isolate these three issues that impact whether your child is within a state system, higher education, secure institution, or anywhere else in Pennsylvania.
So you're saying your own children don't talk about these issues?
Actually, my children do. My son is a community organizer in North Philadelphia. You know, he is drenched in working with medical professions in harm reduction. So he works in the opioid crisis. And in fact, I learned about some of these issues from my children. My daughter is also a physician and deals with these issues.
I misunderstood. When you said millennials, I thought you were talking about your own children. You were talking about the millennials who are students at the state system.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Sorry about that. But I misunderstood you were talking. But these students that are and I think that it's a good representation when we're talking about Asian American Pacific Islanders in Pennsylvania. Why don't they talk about these issues?
I want to clarify one thing. Actually, our millennials are pretty amazing. They do talk about these issues. And while we are not, you know, targeting the millennials or Gen X, the silence really comes from the baby boomers. The parents. And I think I just want to be very specific about the beauty of our millennials who are, like Tiffany, talking about these issues, our children. And we have not really been able to engage them in these conversations as parents because we have concentrated on some of the other issues, whether it's celebratory, whether it's religious, whether it's cultural. You know, that reaffirm us as immigrants. On the other hand, our millennial children have been dealing with it, and they're working in the trenches. This symposium brings this generational divide together and helps us talk together about these two issues, mm-hmm. three issues, rather.
And Tiffany, you know, something that she was just talking about, and you have the words in when you sent an email to me about this symposium, cultural taboos. And that sounds like what's being described here.
Absolutely. These topics are really difficult just to talk, you know, with any Americans, any Pennsylvanians. But when you layer immigrant communities that, that you know, are often, you know, patriarchal, patrilineal, who are coming to the United States, there may be language barriers and, you know, it becomes even tougher to broach these topics. The other piece of it is exactly what Sue just highlighted, is the generational gap. You know, do our elders even know what opioids are? Do they even know? There's a disconnect, right, between what is happening in Pennsylvania and, you know, what Governor Wolf is doing, what our administration is doing around the opioid epidemic, declaring a state of emergency, and what the community is aware exists. And that's really the generational divide that we're trying to bridge, as well as the awareness of the resources. You know, if you talk to any Asian American woman, or even any Asian, specifically Asian American women, they have or they know of people in their lives that have been affected by sexual assault and domestic violence. I mean, the national numbers tell us that 2 in 5 South Asian women are survivors of domestic violence. So our numbers are incredibly high, but there is a lack of ability for people to talk about this in a public forum. And that's what we're trying to create, a platform for public engagement to discuss these issues that is safe and that has direct resources right there for people to utilize.
2 out of 5.
2 out of 5 South Asian
that's actually higher than the population as a whole.
Yep. 2 out of 5 South Asian immigrant women in the United States are survivors of domestic violence. Mm.
And sexual assault. Often on this program, we've talked about sexual assault. And one of the real challenges is that often it goes unreported.
Mm-hmm.
And that's everyone. That is overall. So I'm wondering if the incidence of domestic violence are higher. Are there more Asian American Pacific Islander women not reporting sexual assault?
I would say absolutely. If you look at the numbers, they're not consistent with the reporting numbers. They're not consistent with the population that is currently here in Pennsylvania. And the underreporting is for so many reasons. I mean, again, cultural taboos, and, you know, not being aware, not realizing that there are resources available. And also, you know, are those resources that are available, are they linguistically accessible? Are they culturally appropriate?
Scott, if I may add something to this, responding to this lack of resources specifically for the Asian and South Asian communities around domestic violence and sexual assault, New York, New Jersey realized that, and South Asian communities came together to respond. We are learning from these best practices. In fact, we have invited a New York metropolis-based organization called SUCCI that concentrates on anti-domestic violence, specifically culturally attuned to the South Asian community. A resource such as that does not exist in our area, in our 3-county area. We have close to 20,000 AAPI living in this area. So while we may not have the resource to create a SUCCI or a Manavi, Manavi was the first such organization in the state of New Jersey, at least we do have the power, especially with the amount of resources that Governor Wolf has made available on these important issues, to at least empower through education, through awareness.
Mm. So what are some, I mean, we've already touched on some of them, but if these organizations existed and were able to address some of the unique issues that South Asians are dealing with, what would they be dealing with? What would they be addressing, I guess, is the question.
Mm-hmm. So the language barrier is huge in the AAPI. We will release this report in fall. But we, just to understand and appreciate the AAPI community, and a huge shout out to Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education, we did a deep dive into the numbers around the 425,000 that live in our state. About 78% of these families speak a second language as compared to 8% for Pennsylvania in general. So language, besides, there are cultural nuances which a lot of times inhibit South Asian women or Asian women, East Asian women, to really talk about it. So having a network approach is extremely important. I cannot say we are subject matter experts. That is the reason we are doing it, to serve our community, to bring in experts, to talk about it so that we can learn together. What I will say is that the learning curve, as we reflect back when we started 4 months back to today, has been enormous. For example, 4 months back, kudos to the planning committee members who have given their heart and soul. They are the ones who have converted this town hall into a symposium. We all learned together that more Pennsylvanians die of opioid overdoses than fatal vehicle accidents. So in response, what did we do? We have the resource fair that Tiffany will talk about, but we also have really valued speakers who will come and talk to the audience about what are the commonly used drugs as a parent you could come across. What are the basics of harm reduction? I learned about that term from my son. Are other adults aware of it? Baby boomers, Gen X, what is the scope of the opioid epidemic specific to the AAPI? We will even provide a brief a training on overdose response and naloxone administration. This was necessary. It wouldn't have been possible if we didn't come together and realize we needed to learn more.
Mm-hmm. By the way, if you're just tuning in, our guest today, Tiffany Chang Lawson, Executive Director of Governor Tom Wolf's Advisory Commission on Asian Pacific American Affairs, and Dr. Sue Mukherjee, who is Vice Chair of the Commission. We welcome your comments. We're talking about a symposium that will be held this Saturday, this weekend. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Tiffany, I have to admit that some of the issues that we're discussing, that a lot of it kind of goes back to, at least the lack of awareness, goes back to that stereotype that Asian American Pacific Islanders have stable families, that this population couldn't possibly have an opioid problem, sexual assault, domestic violence, bullying. Okay, bullying may be a little bit different, but couldn't possibly have these programs or these problems because the families are so strong.
And Scott, that's why when we talked in May, it's that the model minority myth, I mean, on its face, you might think, oh, that's a great stereotype for people to think about your community. But it's so harmful because it masks the inequities that exist. You know, if providers have potentially an unconscious bias that an Asian American victim, like, you know, you should be okay because, you know, you come from maybe middle class, two income household. But that doesn't mean that you can't be a survivor of sexual assault or domestic violence, or that you can't have opioid addiction. I mean, we know in doing, you know, governors, our administration doing the Opioid Command Center and all the work that we've done on opioids, that the opioid epidemic has hit everybody in Pennsylvania. Most everyone in Pennsylvania knows somebody or has a story about how the opioid epidemic has affected them. And we know that anybody can be affected by it. So why not also with the Asian American Pacific Islander community? And it's really working through that also internally as a community, because, you know, there are segments of our population that have kind of bought into the model minority myth and saying that, no, these are issues that exist and we're doing a disservice to our community by not talking about it and ensuring that there are access to resources.
Do you know someone who has an opioid problem?
I do. There was a person who was an extended family member who passed away from an overdose a year ago.
Overdose of?
Of opioids.
But, I mean, heroin?
Heroin.
Okay. And I don't mean to get too much into whatever you want to volunteer.
Actually, may I add to that? The four-month planning committee that came together came at the heels of a death of a South Asian young man of opioid overdose.
Mm-hmm.
This has hit home. But that aside, I do want to take, because I'll do a disservice to the higher education community, to the state system of higher education, if I didn't mention that there is no monolithic. There are incredible differences in unemployment rate, education attainment, and poverty in the 29 ethnic communities that comprise the Asian American Pacific Islander. And by not looking at the nuances, you know, these are the tough issues, but also general issues that all Pennsylvanians need to embrace to live and thrive are being overlooked on.
And I wasn't asking that question to pry into your business or anything or to test you, but just to show that it is something that we all know someone who has had an issue, a problem with opioids. Probably we all know someone who has been the victim of sexual assault or been bullying. Let's talk a little bit about bullying. Who is the bullier? I don't know if that's the word or not. But when we're talking about Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, who is doing the bullying? Are Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders the victims? And what are they being bullied about?
Scott, I would say I think that bullying is a challenge that affects all students, right? Regardless of race, religion, ethnicity, sexual orientation. I mean, it's pretty pervasive. And when you throw into the mix cyberbullying, I mean, bullying is a really big issue on in our schools here in Pennsylvania, but we wanted to really delve deeper into bullying within the Asian American context because, you know, we have data that shows that Asian American students are concerned about their safety at school at a higher rate than potentially than white students, and. You also add into that, you know, Asian American Muslim students, Asian American Muslim girls who are wearing hijab, right? There's due to our national climate, there is a greater increase in bullying and, you know, hate crimes associated with, you know, people and children that wear hijab and are Muslims. And so these are things that we're taking into account. And what we find is, you know, children don't often tell their parents when they are experiencing bullying at schools. They want to save their parents from potential shame or humiliation or just the kind of emotional burden of knowing how bad it could potentially be at school. And we wanted to create a safe space for students. We have one of our workshops, which is our Bullying and Microaggressions Youth Workshop, which is being led by some really incredible Asian American youth for Asian American youth. And they're going to facilitate a dialogue around what their experiences are with bullying in schools and what kind of forms that bullying has taken. Is it cyberbullying, right? Or is it physical harassment in the hallways at school? What does that bullying look like? And then what resources are available for those youth?
Resources is important as part of the symposium, right?
Absolutely. We have a resource fair that will take place throughout the course of our lunch hour and the day. And we have over 20 state, local, and nonprofit providers participating in that resource fair.
Are there a lot of Asian American Pacific Islanders who are not aware of the resources?
Yes.
Why?
Yes. You know, I've worked in state government for a very long time. It's reaching out, dissemination of what we do is a challenge, you know, with the resources. Outreach is always a challenge. And when you have communities that have chosen to, you know, sort of live within their own circles, that dissemination becomes challenging. Besides, if you're not willing to open and see what these tough issues are, you're probably not acknowledging you or your loved ones have a need for those resources. I do want to share that when we had the community leaders meeting at the Dixon University Center, this was the first time in the history, you know, Indians and Pakistanis and Chinese and Vietnamese, they do come together within their own circles. This is the first time in the history of this area we had all 60 community leaders coming together, and there were so many personal stories to share that they had chosen not to share before. So once you start acknowledging, you look at resources in a different manner also.
Brad from Harrisburg says, longtime listener, first time emailer, which thank you, Brad, for listening all the time, and we'd like to hear from you more. How do you get tickets to the symposium?
You can register on Eventbrite. You can also, we just launched our official Facebook page. So you can find us on Facebook at Governor Wolf's Advisory Commission on Asian Pacific American Affairs, and you can get tickets online. It is free, but we do request registrations.
And mate, to that, thanks, Brad. We just want to say everyone is welcome. This is going to be a learning experience for all Pennsylvanians. And while we have paid attention to the needs of the AAPI community, we are all Pennsylvanians, ultimately, and we want to learn together and grow together on these tough issues.
You anticipated my next question, and that is, and by the way, we only have a minute or so left, is who is the target? Who do you want to reach with the symposium?
Our fellow colleagues in the Central Pennsylvania, Cumberland, Perry, Dauphin, we are in this together. I believe everyone who attends will come back with a different learning. You will learn about the tough issues for sure. You will appreciate the AAPI diaspora. Maybe you'll make some friends. Maybe you will network. But we all need to learn together to come to a greater point of understanding and appreciation.
Tiffany, about 30 seconds.
I just want to say that this has truly been a community effort. There's no, and I want to also, you know, thank Governor Wolf and the administration for all of their support in having this happen. I mean, the state agencies have really rallied behind this. But I also want to thank several community restaurants that are actually donating food for the lunch. Himalayan Fusion, we have Royal Buffet and Grill, and we also have Passage to India and Yummy Korean. And, you know, they are... This has really been a community effort, and I'm so grateful for everybody's support.
I want to thank you for being with us, and we will have on our website, WITF.org, link to that Facebook page as well. Tiffany Chang Lawson, Executive Director of Governor Tom Wolf's Advisory Commission on Asian Pacific American Affairs, and Dr. Sue Mukherjee, who is Vice Chair of the Commission. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to talk about the state's efforts looking into solar power.